Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, U.S. Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Cap Bailey, and with me today is senior writer Bob Mackey.
Hello, everybody.
Why, hello. No Nadia this week, because she is taking a well-earned vacation. So we're going to cover a whole bunch of topics in the RPG spectrum this week. We're going to do some RPG news. We're going to talk a bit about Bob's localization feature from last week, and we're going to cover a new feature that we're going to be doing for a few weeks here, SNES Highlights, in which we take a franchise, like a long-running franchise that was around during the Super Nintendo era, and we kind of talk about what did the Super Nintendo mean for that RPG franchise. And in this case, we'll be starting with kind of the granddaddy of the JRPG, Dragon Quest. So the first bit of RPG news that we should probably hit is we're going to say rest in peace to Manabu Daishima, who passed away at the only 45, which is kind of a tragedy. So he was responsible for the field art for Chrono Trigger, the 3D map design for Dirge of Cerberus and Final Fantasy XII, and the world graphic design for Secret of Mana. His final title was Parasite Eve, the Third Birthday. I gotta say, if like he was responsible for like the field art of Final Fantasy XII and Chrono Trigger, he was really darn good at what he did.
Yeah, he was actually. I saw Gamasutra had a little bio of him, and he's in the developer room at the end of Chrono Trigger, the ultimate ending that you can get. You can meet him, and he's in that room. He just says, "Buy more Squaresoft games. Look for upcoming Squaresoft games."
What a shame.
Yeah, but it goes to show you, like, the people who make the things you like the most, you probably don't know their names, you know? You don't know who makes the sprite graphics or the background art and things like that, so it's important that we remember these people, not just the director, not just the big egos out there.
Yeah, we like to get into auteur theory a lot with video games, so you're right, we forget that there's probably the artisans in the background who are responsible for like the little things that you love. And I would say that we don't necessarily think about it, but certainly the field art and the world graphic design can make a big difference, especially in a classical JRPG. Mm-hmm. All right. Next piece of news. Dragon Quest X confirmed for the NX.
Yeah, in Japan though, right? let's say that at least.
Yeah, it's not coming out here. I was
remarking, what a weird time to be alive. Like, Dragon Quest X comes out in 2012 as an MMORPG for the Wii. Like, that could never happen outside of the context of 2012 or 2011.
Why? Which is pretty amazing. Why would you say, like, the context of 2012 or 2011?
I mean, just like, they jumped on the Wii, you know, as it was taking off. And by the time Dragon Quest X was done, the Wii was in the state that it was. And that's why it exists as a Wii MMORPG. Of course, it's on the PC as well in Japan, but it started on the Wii. It just feels like a choice that was made when during those first crazy years of the Wii that you know, probably didn't really work out for them, you know, much later.
Remember when it was confirmed for the Wii U, and we were like, "Oh man, Dragon Quest MMO for the Wii U! Like, that's a killer app right there."
We won't be talking about this on the podcast, I don't think, but Little King's Story and a number of other games where developers were skeptical about the Wii, and then it had an amazing first 2 years, so everyone jumped onto development, and by the time their games were out, like No More Heroes, things like that, Mad World, the party had ended, and they were out of luck. So that was like a lot of Wii-exclusive games like that, like Xenoblade Chronicles, Dragon Quest X, Pandora's Tower, Last Story, all of these games that we're trying to take advantage of the Wii's longevity that never really was in the cards for that system.
I mean, we say that the Wii didn't have any longevity, but it was still selling like crazy through 2009.
True, but the people who were buying Wiis did not want to buy The Last Story or Xenoblade. They wanted Wii Sports. They wanted Wii Fit. Maybe something to shut the kids up, like Mario Kart, but they were not looking for those third-party exclusive games.
Yeah, and then we had that nice little Wii RPG like run between, what was it, Last Story and Xenoblade Chronicles, and if you want to count it, Pandora's Tower.
Yeah, sure, why not?
It was like bang, 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 but it all came out in like 2011, 2012, when the party definitely was over by then. So,
that's for sure.
And to the point where Nintendo almost didn't bring those games out for some reason, even though it was down to bringing a Dragon Quest board game.
Yeah, oh boy.
Yeah, not a Dragon Quest board game, but it was by the creator of Dragon Quest.
Yeah, it was the Itagaki Street, I think. I don't know. I forget what you call it, but I wanted to like that game, but hey, maybe if you're asking me to play a four-hour board game, let me save halfway through at some point. I was like, what, you literally can't do that? What is this?
Yeah, but Dragon Quest X for the NX, probably not coming out here in the U.S., right?
I think that ship has sailed. I feel like Dragon Quest is such a niche product to begin with, to the point where they're replacing the orchestrated soundtrack in the 3DS version for us. It's just going to be straight up MIDI, or MIDI, however you want to say it. I feel like if they're cutting costs that slim, localizing an MMO plus 3+ years worth of extra content is way not even in the cards for Dragon Quest.
Yeah, and MMORPGs in general, like, I mean, as a genre, it's still viable, but it's certainly not where it used to be.
No.
And certainly not on a console.
That's for sure.
I feel like Final Fantasy 14 is kind of like the peak of where you're going to get with a console MMO at this point.
Yeah, they've done a very good job of making it playable on a console, but that it feels like an outlier. Like Blizzard was never interested in bringing World of Warcraft to consoles, which felt kind of odd to me, but I guess it worked out for them. They weren't losing money, really.
Yeah, they weren't losing money, and I mean, World of Warcraft is a complex and very customizable game, and that would have like been all of that would have been lost in like a PS2 or Xbox 360 port.
Yeah,
they'd have to... Dragon Quest XI was okay on the PS2.
11? Oh, Final Fantasy 11, right?
Final Fantasy 11,
yeah,
sorry.
I don't know how. I assume you had to have a keyboard and mouse to play that game.
But Dragon Quest X, on the other hand, actually did pretty well in Japan. And
as all Dragon Quest games do.
I had totally forgotten about it until I was in a convenience store while I was in Japan last month. And I just randomly saw a Dragon Quest X like, poster like saying... you can get in-game items like through a promotion at the convenience store. I'm like, holy crap, Dragon Quest X is not only still a thing, but it's still getting promoted at convenience stores? Wow.
I believe there's even a 3DS port. I think you can even play it on a 3DS, which is nuts.
That is nuts.
But it was designed for a console controller, but like, this kind of irks me. For as much as this probably is not a great game, I still at least wanted to try it, because just having Final Fantasy stuff made me play Final Fantasy 14 and it got me into MMOs for the first time in my life. So I feel like I at least want to play this game for like a month. I never will. I'm not going to learn Japanese to play Dragon Quest X, but I feel like I wish
there was you should, and they should like write about it.
Yes, I'm sure that will get millions of hits.
Millions.
Yeah. But I just feel like, oh, it's the one Dragon Quest game I literally can never play. And that kind of bothers me a little bit.
Well, by all accounts, it wasn't actually that great.
Yeah.
Final Fantasy 14 ended up being a much better game. Dragon Quest X was pretty old school MMORPG experience.
That's what I've heard. Yeah.
Very grindy. So there it goes. If it never comes out for the NX, I won't be all that sad. However, I would like to see Dragon Quest XI on the NX, especially if all of the rumors of it being portable. Friendly console is true.
Oh god, yes. And
but again, so far hasn't been really confirmed.
Not confirmed for the US even in any form yet.
Give me my Dragon Quest 11.
Yeah, but again, like we said on past episodes, like if you want to see these games, buy builders, buy 7 and 8 when they come to 3DS. Like show Square Enix that you want these games, because they're not going to care unless you vote with your wallet.
Well, the fact that Dragon Quest Builders is coming out in the U.S. should be kind of positive, right? Like, if anything didn't come out here, it would be that.
I feel like the Minecraft connection makes that a more likely choice than like something like 7. and the much smaller localization, I think. Like, I feel like they'd be willing to take a risk on that and not a traditional remake for a 3DS, but I'm glad they did both. I'm glad they're bringing both over.
I am too. And I think that Dragon Quest at this point is well known enough that it is not quite the risky proposition to come out. It's never going to top out in the same way as like a Final Fantasy game can in the US, but it still has a very loyal fan base. Yeah, if Monster Hunter is getting localized, then Dragon Quest should be localized.
I was about to say Monster Hunter. Like, it does feel like Monster Hunter in that it will never be, ever be as big as it is or was in Japan, but it's got enough of a group that knows about it and is willing to proselytize to other people that it's worthwhile for them to bring it over here.
Well, Monster Hunter's potential has always been artificially capped here in the U.S. because yeah. We just don't think of handheld consoles as multiplayer machines. We want to play those kinds of games on the PC and on the consoles. And so, like, I've always felt that if it had come out on, say, the Xbox 360 or the PlayStation 4, that and had been, like, optimized for those consoles and had good online infrastructure, that it would have done much, much better because the concept behind it is really compelling and people like co-op, for God's sake. But it was always limited to the Wii or the 3DS or the PSP. Two of those consoles, which ended up having a somewhat more limited following here in the US. So.
Well, I mean, there was a Wii U version, which I thought was really good for what it
was. Oh, right. Yes, there was a Wii U version, which has the smallest install base of any Nintendo console
wow.
ever.
Wow.
Outside of Virtual Boy. No, it's
oh,
like
the Wii U itself?
It was like half of that of the GameCube.
Yikes. Yeah, but that was the only way to play 3U online, just like on the internet, period, was the Wii U version. The 3DS version could not go online. So that's why I played that one and I liked it. If they would just make a straight port of every game for something else, not even touching up the graphics, I'd be fine with it because this is getting into a Monster Hunter conversation, but I can only play an online game with my 3DS for so long before my hands and body start to hurt. And my arms start to go numb from holding a thing up for so long.
Anyway, it doesn't really matter like how popular it gets or how much it sells at the end of the day, as long as it keeps coming out here in the US and I can play it. So
yeah,
that's what it comes down to. And I really want Dragon Quest XI on the NX. But let's move on, Bob. Last week, you posted a really good feature.
Oh, well, thank you.
True Tales of Localization.
Hell.
Hell.
That's right. I said a damn hell-ass swear on our website.
Could you, like, kind of give us an overview of some of the stories and, like, some of the things that you learned in writing about this?
Well, some people might not know, but I actually did localization work for Atlas for a while, and before I worked for 1UP, and then in between 1UP and US Gamer, I localized games for them. I don't speak Japanese, I don't read it, I just polish up the raw scripts that come in, and you know, they put those in the game. But that experience and just being a fan of Japanese games in general led me to think of an idea. Like, there's been a lot of misconceptions about what localization is and how easy it is. So I want to reach out to people who have done this in the past with some particularly difficult projects and talk to them, get their stories, and show how far we've come and just, like, the sheer difficulty in moving something from one language to another, because it is not a literal thing that you're doing. It requires a lot more nuance, and it's very subject to your preferences, but it's a supremely difficult process in any case, and I wanted to look at the most difficult examples from the industry.
So what were some of your favorite stories that you heard? I will set you up on this one.
Okay.
Actually, I love the story of Tidus.
Oh yeah,
like how the laughing scene was localized.
That's true. So with Final Fantasy X, that was Square. I mean, Square had done voice acting in games before, but that was the first Final Fantasy with voice acting, and voice acting synced up to actual movements of mouth movements on the screen. So the localizer, Alexander O. Smith, who you might recognize from things like Vagrant Story, Final Fantasy XII, Phoenix Wright, he worked on that project within Square, and they were not really given a lot of information about how the voice process would work, but far too late in the process, they learned that their audio clips that were replacing the Japanese audio clips had to be precise to the Japanese. There was no over or under, it had to be exact, or else it would screw up the animation, it would crash the game, so what Alexander found himself doing was rewriting scripts to fit these very specific mouth movements, these very specific times, right down to the frame. Like, he was explaining how in Japan, if you want to say yes, it's just like hi. It's like you're just making a vowel sound and cutting it off with your throat. Saying yes requires a lot more frames of animation and frames for sound, because that S sound drags out. So you have to figure out ways to get around even simple things like saying yes. So you might notice that Yuna and the rest of the characters go mm a lot instead of saying yes or yeah or whatever. I mean, there are just so many little things that he did to account for these insane restrictions on what could and could not be said within the English language version of the game. And he managed to make, I would say, a flawed localization, but one that was actually passable. I mean, something always seemed off to me, and just knowing what he had to go through explains everything to do with that localization, at least in terms of voice acting.
And in terms of the laughing scene,
okay.
I mean, there's an argument that's made within this piece that what we got in America was actually quite a bit better than what it was in Japan.
Yes, I mean, this may irk some people, but Alex was talking about how the melodrama is much more heightened in Japan, and his job as a localizer making things for an American audience is to sort of temper that melodrama and make it less over the top, less ridiculous. But there was no getting around that in with the laughing scene. Like, there is no way to massage that to make it not so on the nose, not so over the top. But he did the best he could, and he was explaining how within the feature, one of the scriptwriters for the game, I believe it was Nojima, he was actually taking improv classes at the time, and an improv exercise you do to sort of loosen up is to fake laugh, and that sort of becomes real laughter, and you get to, you know, be more in touch with your body and your movement and stuff like that. So he sort of adapted that to Final Fantasy X, which leads to one of the more awkward scenes in the game, which Alexander O. Smith will even agree it's not a very convincing scene in Japanese, but it makes a little more sense within the context of the game, not so much when you're viewing it on YouTube itself. But that scene always stood out to me as a slightly embarrassing part of that game. One where I was like, while it was happening, I believe I was like, okay, time to shut my bedroom door. I don't want my mom or sister seeing me playing this right now.
Yeah.
This is kind of weird. But yeah, like, stories like that. I mean, obviously we're dealing with a much, much more advanced tools, a much higher standard of things. But a lot of these stories were from the past, just showing how far we've come. And even though we've come such a far away, translation and localization is still not easy, and you're still not going to please everybody. But I believe, like, I chose some pretty notable games. Final Fantasy X would probably be the most notable. I also talked to Jeremy Blaustein, who did localizations for games like Snatcher, Metal Gear Solid, Silent Hill 2 and 3. He did the translation for Dragon Warrior 7 when it came out here in 2001, and that sounds like the most harrowing localization project I've ever heard in my life.
Was he doing that one alone? Like, how big of a staff?
I believe he had around like 10 to 12 translators, something like that, or localizers, whatever, editors. But if you look at the feature itself, I have a photo of the entire Dragon Quest 12 script, which takes up the entirety of like a medium-sized IKEA bookshelf, all in binders. It was at some Dragon Quest event. They just had like the script on display, and he had to translate with his team that entire script and make it work within the context of a consistent narrative. And the fact that the localization just comes off as a little stiff is a miracle. It could have been much, much worse. But stories like that are what I wrote about within that cover story.
You know, so much of the talk this year has been about localization and like people being mad because such and such got cut from Fire Emblem or from Tokyo Mirage Festival sessions or things like that. Last night I got together with a friend, and for whatever reason we ended up talking about Final Fantasy XIII.
Okay.
And that reminded me that Final Fantasy XIII actually has a real great example of a localization success story. So maybe people forget that there is a character named Saz in that game.
Oh, yeah.
And Saz is, his defining characteristic in Final Fantasy XIII is that he has a son.
I thought it was he has an afro.
He has an afro with a chocobo in it.
I mean, his name is basically named after his afro. I don't know if you know the story behind that.
No, I didn't.
I mean, it's kind of it's a little iffy in terms of their intent, but it was like, oh yes, his hair reminds us of suds and beer, so we're gonna call him Saz.
Oh,
so
okay.
Yeah, that's the origin of Saz. It's a character defined by his afro.
And the fact that he's black.
Yeah,
And he, in the Japanese version, he puts on a very Richard Pryor-esque kind of in Superman 3 performance.
Oh, yeah.
Where he's just like screaming. He's like, oh my God, wow, we're all going to die. And it's like extremely over the top. And it's kind of clear that he's the butt of the jokes for a lot of that game. And isn't necessarily meant to be taken seriously. And I was like, oh man, I wonder what they're going to do with this kind of silly character for Final Fantasy XIII's localization here in America. Because I think that in Japan, there isn't quite as much sensitivity toward racial issues as it pertains to, the black community and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, we saw things like that with games like Resident Evil 5, where it was like, you're borrowing imagery that might look cool to you, but you don't understand the context, so it's not coming off the way you want it to.
Right. And of course, like, Barrett is an example.
Yes, exactly.
Like, a lot of people are, like, rolling their eyes at this character.
We are. I do want to see how Barrett is remade in Final Fantasy VII. Is he going to be a Mr. T figure again, or...
I think he's going to end up being a Mr. T figure again.
Really? Okay. I want to.
I mean, have you watched the gameplay demos and everything, right?
I don't think I have, actually.
Oh, they did the demo last year at the PlayStation Experience.
Oh,
and
okay.
You actually saw like gameplay, and they were showing scenes from the opening raid on the reactor, and you actually saw Barrett talking, and he seemed fairly similar to how he was portrayed
was
in Final Fantasy VII.
Mr. T is still alive. He could do the dub. It only makes sense.
Makes total sense. But my point with Saz was that they did a fantastic job with him and made him the most sympathetic character in the game. He became like kind of the voice of reason in that game, like maybe the only sane man, where like everybody else was kind of crazy and kind of kooky and kind of over the top. Like he was kind of along the ride, and you could identify with his desire to find a son, like his almost desperate desire to find a son. And I mean, kind of hats off to the writing and the voice acting in that one, because they really salvaged that character.
But all, at the same time, we also got the immortal line, "Moms are tough," in the first minute, which just feel like it felt like a Kix commercial or something like that.
I really want to go back and play Final Fantasy XIII.
No, you don't.
And I don't?
No.
When was the last time you played it?
Have you played it before?
Oh, yeah. I reviewed it.
Okay.
I didn't review it. No, I did the guide for it, which is even worse.
I had inklings of that when I downloaded the PC version when it came out a year or so ago, and I was like, maybe I'll play through this again. I enjoyed it. But then you realize, like, oh, I can't actually play this until, like, hour 30. Again, it's the same thing we talked about, like, 6 years ago. Like, it never lets you play until it's completely sure, you dummy, that you can get every possible mechanic. And that's still very frustrating, even more so after you've actually finished the game. You're like, can I just have access to all these mechanics? Oh, no, I can't. I'm good.
Yeah, no, they went really over the top with the tutorialization. And that was one thing we were actually discussing in our conversation last night. But I think the flip side of that is that the actual boss encounters in particular were really, really good.
They were, yeah. I do like the battle system, and I liked it even more in 13-2.
I didn't. I actually thought that it fell apart in 13-2.
Well, I mean, the balance falls apart at the halfway point, but that battle system is still there, and I liked playing with it without having to wait to get to all the meat of it.
Yeah, that was ultimately my problem with Final Fantasy XIII's battle system, was that it relied too heavily on these extremely carefully balanced scenarios that stemmed from the fact that you were basically running on a straight line through the entire game.
That's true. They knew what you were going to be fighting. They knew what level you'd be at and things like that. So,
yeah, which is fine, but not necessarily RPG-ish, more action game-ish. Which, whatever. So, is there anything else you want to share from your localization feature?
I mean, I encourage people to read it, but I should have tantalized you with a few of the stories. It really, I think, should shed light on the difficulties of localization and why, if you are picky about localization, why things can't always be the way you want them to be. And that's not me trying to be patronizing. It's such a tricky prospect. It's such an imperfect art, just translation in general, that we should really respect the people that do it and make games playable in English. And we've come so far that I feel like it's thanks to these people like Jeremy and Alex that we have really good localizations these days, and we should be thankful to them for, you know, being pioneers, making things better than just, like, acceptable.
Yeah, no, you really said it when you said that it was an extremely tricky art, because I took a localization test once. I took 8.4's localization test on a whim just to see, like, how hard it would be, and it was really freaking hard because
yes.
You're not only thinking about how you would write the line and you're trying to be faithful to the context of the original language, but you have lots of like barriers. You have like lots of artificial restrictions in terms of like character count and like literal space within the box and everything. And like, I mean, you were talking about in Final Fantasy X where you literally had... It had to fit with the Japanese exactly. Like, I can't even imagine doing the entire script like that. And they made it look so seamless. It's actually really incredible.
Yeah. I mean, there are some odd parts to Final Fantasy X, just the way characters talk and just sort of like stiltedness to a lot of it. But again, I now knowing how it was made, it feels like it's a miracle that it even became that good in the end.
All right. So go check out Bob's localization article, True Tales of Localization Hell.
That's right. There's two F-words in there, too, so...
Oh, my God.
That's real journalism, if you can swear. That's what I learned.
That's what we learned. Go check it out on usgamer.net. All right, continuing onward. This is the 25th anniversary of the Super Nintendo, which...
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of crazy if you think about it.
It is. It's crazy for me because I've been freelancing for like 15 years, but when I moved out to the Bay Area to work for 1UP, it was the 20th anniversary of the SNES, so now I feel like it's time for me to start repeating myself until I die.
When Retronauts started in 2006, was there argument over whether the Super Nintendo was... retro or not yet, or was there, were people pretty much like saying, no, the PlayStation isn't retro, just the Super Nintendo and the Nintendo
I'm
and
sure,
the Atari.
I mean, people are such sticklers. I'm sure that in 2006, when the SNES was only 15, I'm sure people were like, well, it's not Atari, so, or it's not NES, so yeah, who cares? But
the GameCube's 15 now.
Yeah. But
thinking about like that gap in the distance is like, oh, the GameCube definitely feels old now. But
it does, yeah.
It's still hard to wrap my mind around it being retro.
About 3D games being retro. Yeah, I mean, but as we get older, people's first systems are going to start being like the Xbox 360 and the PS3, and we're going to have to deal with that. So
yeah,
it's all a matter of perspective.
One of 8.4's interns is like 21, and he was like, yeah, my first system was pretty much the N64. And then, I'm just like, wow, you're... so young.
Yes, our modern N64 kids are now entering the workplace. They are our youngest adults now, so.
But the Super Nintendo, I mean, I kind of want to focus on the Super Nintendo because
yeah.
It was so important for RPGs as we know them.
That's where
certainly JRPGs.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I played Final Fantasy and Dragon Warrior and stuff on NES, but Super Nintendo is really where my love of RPGs, specifically JRPGs, solidified and became like, this is all I want to buy, this is all I want to play. Thankfully, I play other stuff now, I'm not so much set in my ways, but I was pretty much just an RPG kid and like buying everything that came out, reading all the previews, pre-ordering everything. Just, yeah, it really solidified my love of the genre.
It also brought with it its own kind of mystique because, I mean, of course, RPGs were not only not big in America back in, say, on consoles at least, back in 1991 through 1994, but they were kind of looked down upon. It was very strange. People were like, well, our console RPGs just aren't going to translate to America. So as a result, like the Super Nintendo certainly had plenty of great RPGs that came out here, but lots of RPGs that never did. And in that respect, we had like really big important games like Dragon Quest V, Final Fantasy V, Seiken Densetsu 3, like a huge chunk of the Fire Emblem series, which simply never came over here, or at least did not come over here until much later. So that gave the Super Nintendo like this kind of, I suppose, hardcore cred. Like, yeah, maybe you've played Final Fantasy IV or Final Fantasy II, but did you know that it was actually called Final Fantasy IV in Japan, and that there's a Final Fantasy V?
They've been lying to us. Yeah, I mean, the state of RPGs at that time made a lot of publishers gun shy. In fact, like it's funny that like Capcom for Breath of Fire 1, they were like, "Hey, Square, how about you publish this? We don't want to." And that was such a weird phenomenon. Like they were that gun shy about Breath of Fire.
Well, it was seen as a very niche thing.
Yeah.
But the upshot of all this is that the Super Nintendo was, by many people, seen as the golden console for JRPGs. Like, that it never got, that it was never as good after that. And there are a ton of RPGs from that system that still hold up incredibly well today. And is home to maybe the greatest JRPG ever made, which is Chrono Trigger.
Ooh.
But we're going to do... We're just going to take a look at a few key franchises from Super Nintendo history. And in this episode, I'm going to talk about Dragon Quest, which, for a little context, there had been 4 Dragon Quests by this point. Dragon Quest 1, 2, 3, and 4 all came out on the NES. And Dragon Quest V marked the first transition over to the Super Famicom. It was pretty early on in its life cycle, too. I think it was like 1992 that it came out.
Yeah, it's not even a great-looking game. I don't think Chunsoft, who developed it, were really used to the SNES at this point. So it looks like it's a very plain-looking game that's a little bit more colorful than an NES game. But 6 would be the Dragon Quest that really looks great. It like really takes advantage of the hardware like a Squaresoft game did.
Yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, like...
I think Would 5 is a better game, though.
Oh, I think 5 is a better game as well. Would you say that... So, I tend to think of Dragon Quest 4, 5, and 6 all in the same category because they all came out on the DS, which is when I like really started getting my true introduction to the series. And I think of Dragon Quest 4 as being fairly ambitious in the way that it split up the characters into like multiple chapters, right? Like it had like lots of different storylines and it was already kind of trying something new and different.
Yeah, every Dragon Quest after, 1, 2, and 3 are all great, and 3 is a really big, ambitious game, kind of like an open world game of its time. But I think from 4 onwards, every Dragon Quest had its own like interesting gimmick or interesting like new way of doing your standard Dragon Quest stuff. And that's true of 5 and 6.
Well, the interesting thing about Dragon Quest on the Super Nintendo, though, was this was maybe a real opportunity to kind of step forward and like be a lot more ambitious, but that they really stuck to the previous formula, and that ended up kind of setting the precedent for the series, like through all the way up until, well, Dragon Quest 11 almost. So.
Yeah. I think their ambition was, like, the most revolutionary thing they did in 5 was in the narrative, just the way the story was told, like, telling a human's history from their birth until their, like, rise to, like, greatness. I feel like we don't see games that trace a person's life like that that's not maybe, like, a simulation game, and I feel like that was one of the first RPGs to do that.
You know, like, looking at Dragon Quest, I think that's it's a really good example of how, like, the Super Nintendo, would you say that it has one of the biggest gaps between launch and then what it ultimately became in terms of graphics? Because when the earliest Super Nintendo games, like, with a few exceptions, looked almost like NES games, and Dragon Quest V is an example of that. And then by the time that, say, Final Fantasy VI came out, Chrono Trigger, Donkey Kong Country, like kind of those games, like developers were just pushing that system to the frickin' limits. It was really incredible.
Yeah, I don't know if I go as far as say like a lot of games look like NES games. I feel like Dragon Quest might have been an outlier with 5 in that how kind of low tech it looked, but it did take developers a while to get really understand the SNES, and by the time like 94 or 95 hits, it was like a complete next level. I mean, just compare Final Fantasy 5 to Final Fantasy 6. And I mean, even Final Fantasy IV looks kind of primitive compared to 5.
Pretty primitive, yeah. I would even say.
I mean, like, everything is so tiny and, like, just kind of, like, not detailed. So yeah, it took them a while to understand, like, to change their expectations for what a game should look like, too.
The thing that I think of when I think of those early Super Nintendo games is that the graphics were still kind of primitive, but you didn't really notice it at the time because it's still, the colors were a lot more vibrant, usually.
And it sounded a lot better, too.
And the soundtrack was usually, was obviously a lot better because the soundtrack, Super NES sound chip was kind of like the next level. So a game like Dragon Quest V might not look that much better, but it sure did sound a lot better.
Oh, yeah. That's for sure.
Another thing that kind of stands out to me is while Dragon Quest was relatively, I would say, conservative with its visuals until Dragon Quest VI, I feel like it was a lot more ambitious with its storytelling. What do you think of that?
No, I think so. I think like a lot of the Final Fantasy stuff at this point was just like a very, very melodramatic anime style episodic storytelling. And Dragon Quest does usually go for an episodic format, but with V, it was very much like a very linear progression through a single person's life. And they've not revisited that, and it still feels like a unique approach for RPGs in general.
Yeah, and then when you had Dragon Quest VI, it in some ways, I mean, not quite, but it had the whole two worlds thing was kind of a popular trope back on the Super Nintendo era.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Yuji Horii, who worked on Chrono Trigger, brought some of those ideas over to Dragon Quest. They don't work quite as well because in Chrono Trigger, the different time periods are much more distinct than the kind of light world, dark world of Dragon Quest VI. But I can feel like where his inspirations came from, at least.
Did you play Dragon Quest VI on the Nintendo DS?
Yes, in fact, I'm in like the middle of a playthrough right now, and I really want to go back to it before I play 7. I doubt that will actually happen, but that's the one game I haven't finished in the series.
I ended up reviewing it, and I think I was a little harsh on it.
It's not, I mean, I feel like the Heartbeat developed Dragon Quest, which are 6 and 7, they kind of focus more on content than making, like, meaningful content, so they're kind of bloated as far as games go. I feel like they were sort of like a taste of what the PlayStation generations of RPGs would be like, and yeah, like, I feel like the job system doesn't work that well, and there's just a little too much to do. They're both a little overwhelming.
Yeah, the job system, I remember it being really flawed, but I don't remember exactly what about it was flawed.
Now, they could have changed this for the 3DS version, and I hope they did, but what happens is, you pick up a job, and you join that job class like you would in a Final Fantasy, but there's no AP or JP, like ability points or job points. The game just tells you, go fight strong monsters, and if you do that enough, you'll rise in job rank. And there was really no way of knowing which jobs to prioritize, because if you master one job and another job, you can actually get a new job out of that. So a lot of it was like, no, do your own research first and then come into this game knowing what you're going to do. And I think the 3DS version gives you a bit more guidance with that. But a lot of it was just like not shown to the player, which I felt was a huge problem in a game with like 30 different job classes, like a crazy amount of job classes. So I just felt like the lack of information to the player was a real problem with the class system in that game.
The thing that I feel like Dragon Quest VI's lasting legacy was just that it was gigantic.
Oh, it's huge. Yeah, it's
like
massive.
It went big. Like, this was...
And
this...
7 went even bigger. I mean, like, yeah. Again, the Heartbeat developed games, I think they were like, let's make the biggest RPG we can make, period.
Yeah, but when Enix was making Dragon Quest VI, they were like... They were kind of pushing, like, kind of the best graphics the Super Nintendo could output at that time.
Yeah, it's up there with Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy VI in terms of just how good it looks. I mean, this is the first Dragon Quest where all the enemies are animated in battle instead of just being static sprites. They really went all out to make, like, a pure, beautiful Dragon Quest experience that still really holds up. Like, I honestly feel like the SNES version looks way better than the DS version.
Oh, I completely agree.
Yeah.
And I think the DS version, like, it lost some of what made it special, because when Dragon Quest VI came out, it was a phenomenal looking game. And that was like, first of all, that was like its main selling point, that and how big it was. And then when it came out on the DS, it didn't stand out quite as much because it had basically the same graphics as 4 and 5. Its main thing was that it was really big, it had class system, and it had the kind of the two worlds concept.
A lot of the DS problems, though, in terms of visuals, was it traded the intricate sprite work of the backgrounds for kind of clunky DS polygons that were poorly textured. So you missed a lot of that great hand-drawn artwork that was in 6 because they had to sort of upgrade it for the sake of the DS.
It still looked good on the DS.
No, it looked good. Don't get me wrong. It's a good-looking game, but man, that SNES or Super Famicom version is just gorgeous. It's really gorgeous. Check it out if you have it on YouTube or whatever. It's worth looking into.
But, like, at the risk of kind of going beyond the bounds of this conversation, Dragon Quest VII was a lot more visually conservative on the PlayStation than Dragon Quest VI.
In fact, I think 7 is a much uglier game than 6 because,
Very much so.
Like with the DS version of 6, instead of having, you know, those great sprite backgrounds, it's just like, it's polygonal stuff on the PlayStation, which can be good, but it looks like a circa 97 PlayStation game that unfortunately was released in Japan in 2000 and in America in 2001. It was a game fraught with production problems, and honestly, it probably came out much, much later than they wanted it to, which is why, again, they made it so big to make up for the constant delays, years of delays on that game.
So do you think that Dragon Quest's identity was pretty well set in the NES era, or did it kind of really start to find what it would eventually become in the Super Nintendo era?
To be honest, in America, I think Dragon Quest did not have an identity until Dragon Quest VIII released in 2005 here.
Well, that's because 5 and 6 never came out here.
Yeah, like, what happened with us was 4 came out in 1992. NX tried a few other non-Dragon Quest RPGs through their American branch. That didn't work out either, so they closed up shop. And we went from 92 to 2001 without any Dragon Warrior games, Dragon Quest games. So I feel like the big...
7.
That 7 was 2001.
2001.
Yeah.
Okay,
so, like, I feel like 2004 was the big, like, not a reboot, but sort of like a let's get this going for real. Let's put actual work into this. Let's make a localized version of 8 that is worthwhile for Americans. Let's write a story Bible or like a Bible for this universe that says here's how characters talk. Here's the kind of flair we want to give to the world. And from there, I think we're still in that period of Dragon Quest resurgence. I don't think it has truly died yet, and I'm happy for that. But I don't think like they ever really knew what they were doing until 2004. Like, I feel like that was the first time that they really said, we can't just give up on this. We have to make this appealing. We have to give it more than just a standard localization. We need to make this worthwhile. So to me, at least, that's when... So 7 came out, sorry, 8 came out, 9 came out, 4, 5, and 6 came out for DS. Like, we just had so much Dragon Quest. There was a quiet period, but it's starting up again. We just got Heroes. We're getting Builders 7 and 8 this year. Like, I feel like we're good now. I think those dark days are behind us.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll get 11. But I think that the Super as for the American localization, like, I mean, Dragon Quest or Dragon Warrior was infamously kind of a flop on the NES. And we still got Dragon Warrior 2, 3, and 4 on the NES. But the Super Nintendo was when they officially gave up kind of on the series over here. And it was just kind of acknowledged that Dragon Quest was dead. And it was probably only the revival, or it was the only the explosion of popularity in RPGs on the PlayStation that, like, kind of revived its fortunes. And it's actually a real shame that Dragon Quest VII ended up not being that great in the grand scheme of things. And you can argue with me all day long about this. But if they had, A, put out Dragon Quest VII, and this is, again, getting out of the bounds, if they had put Dragon Quest VII earlier on the PlayStation's life cycle, and it had been maybe a bit more, artistic. I'm not saying that it needed to have, like, Final Fantasy VII level graphics, but it needed to be kind of attractive.
It's an ugly game. I mean, I could tell what they're going for, but it didn't really work. And it was a developer, again, that had never developed for a PlayStation before. And they were figuring it out, and it took them so long because it was just so new to them. And then they folded it right after the game release, so, yeah.
Is it fair to say the Super Nintendo was the height of Dragon Quest?
You know what? I don't know. I don't think so. I think maybe Final Fantasy, it's more fair to say that, in terms of just the quality of the games. But I don't know. I feel like Dragon Quest, they've never really let me down. I don't feel like it's peaked at any point. In fact, 9 is my favorite. It's by far my favorite at this point. So I'm not so sure if that's as true for Dragon Quest. I feel like it was sort of like a less productive period for that series than what Square Enix or Enix at that point wanted from the series.
I think a lot of Japanese Dragon Quest fans would tell you that it peaked with the Famicom.
You're totally right about that. I mean, like, that was just right now we're like, we go between 4 and 5 years per game, and back then it was like maybe 1 to 1.5 years between every game, and it was just like just super prolific, super super popular, super in everyone's face. Everyone was talking about it, and that's much different than waiting 5 years between 6 and 7 for a Japanese audience.
Yeah, you actually really see like the decline, because it's like you get 4 games on the NES, you get 2 on the SNES, and then from that point on you only get 1 per console. Got 1 on the PlayStation 2, and then the Nintendo DS, and then we had the random MMO. Yeah. And now we're finally gonna get Dragon Quest 11, and in a way I'm glad that they're not just pumping these out, that we're not on Dragon Quest 22.
Yeah.
Because the amount of craft and the amount of care that they put in these games is really evident. And I imagine that the degree of difficulty has only gone up as they've moved to more and more sophisticated consoles. And you can see that with the Super Nintendo, right? I mean, the amount of work that had to go into Dragon Quest VI, which was at that time the undisputed biggest and most beautiful Dragon Quest you had ever seen, and was on par with as the most beautiful RPGs on that system. Like, it really went above and beyond, and that stuff takes time to make.
Yeah, just thinking about it, the first 4 games were 86, 87, 88, and 90. That is just incredible. I mean, a different era of game development, just but that compared to the modern era of Dragon Quest that we're in, for like 4 games in 4 years is just like, we did not know how good we had it, at least the Japanese audience didn't.
Well, you could say that Dragon Quest was in a really, really good place with the Super Nintendo. And that even in Japan, it dropped off quite a bit, because simply by virtue of the fact that Dragon Quest VII didn't come out for so long.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, like, if they had their druthers, if they had everything lined up the way they wanted to, that game would have been like a 97 or 98 game. It would not have been a 2000 game. And I felt like that caused Enix to suffer a bit. And that might have helped them, decide to join up with Square. I don't know all the factors that led to that, but I feel like the lateness of Dragon Quest VII really hurt them.
Oh, Square was the one who wanted to join up with Enix because they were pretty much bankrupted by Final right. Fantasy Spirits Within.
I mean, actually, I heard they were in talks before that, but the movie actually delayed their talks. It's like, we're not so sure about this anymore. But I do think, like, just Dragon Quest VII taking 5 years kind of hurt Enix in that era. And again, they never hurt as bad as Square did with their many problems, but 7 was not a good time for them.
I would say that the Super Nintendo was Mark's Dragon Quest's artistic peak. The series itself has been so consistent in its quality, and it doesn't have the peaks and troughs that Final Fantasy does, that it's a little bit harder to pick out a true peak. But I am firm in my belief that Dragon Quest V is not only the best in the series, but maybe one of the best RPGs, period. And that came out on the Super Nintendo and relatively early on. So
it's up there for me, for sure.
So even though there were only just a couple games on the Super Nintendo, like, those were two very, very freaking good games.
I agree. I still prefer the mechanics and the depth of 9, but 5 is very special and it deserves to be lauded.
And ultimately, it didn't advance that much from the Famicom games in terms of structure, but it did give it more freedom
to
experiment
to
with stuff like the monster recruitment, as you said, the much bigger scope of Dragon Quest VI. It gave them room to play, I suppose, and that was good for the series in the long run.
I agree. Yeah.
All right, so we're going to continue on with this. We're going to pick a few more series. If there's a long-running franchise that you want me to highlight in particular on the Super Nintendo, just let me know. You can email me at cat.bailey@usgamer.net, or send me a message on Twitter or DM me on US Gamer. I'm cat.bailey. But before we go, Bob, I have one last thing that I'm going to do.
Sure.
So last week, I asked people to pitch their favorite underrated RPGs, and quite a few people ended up responding. And since I have you here, I feel like this is one that you would definitely appreciate. This is from Brian Wang, and he writes to me, "One underrated RPG I want to draw your attention to is Shadow Hearts Covenant on the PlayStation 2. And this is the one that stands out for him. The game takes place in Europe during World War I, and the pseudo-real-time world in place was a breath of fresh air for me compared to the more commonplace full-on fantasy or sci-fi RPG settings at the time. At the same time, the developers did not feel their cast of characters had to be constrained by historical accuracy and populated your party with a gay vampire wrestler who wielded a coffin as a weapon, an old toy maker accompanied by a lifelike child puppet he referred to as his daughter," that's creepy, "you dress her up in different outfits to grant her different elemental attacks, and Princess Anastasia Romanoff. It was also one of the first instances I can think of where a menu-driven battle system also incorporated a QTE button press event, so you had to pay attention during fights. Wasn't that in Super Mario RPG?"
Yes, but Shadow Hearts, the best way to explain it is like every attack is sort of like playing a golf game. That's how you're stopping. You're like stopping a meter. You're literally seeing a meter, like a little circle. I think it's called like the Wheel of Judgment. For everything you do in the game, a Wheel of Judgment will pop up. And there are like certain zones you can hit it in order to make your attack stronger or just regular or even miss your attacks. So it's more of an explicit, like in terms of presenting the information to the player, it's more of an explicit approach to that.
So those are the top reasons that this made a game a winner for me, and underrated because the series was never continued after its sequel, Shadow Hearts the New World, which didn't quite rise to the same level.
It's pretty good. I like that one too. I finished both of these, and I do feel like these are super overlooked gems. Number one, let's talk about this game was published by Midway in America. What
oh my
the
God.
Hell?
That's yeah. crazy. Like, I bet most people don't even remember Midway at this point because yeah. it's been out of business for so long.
Yeah, I'm trying to, like, I mean, they did a lot of, just what a weird era to have a Midway publish a JRPG. But yeah, like, what I like about Shadow Hearts is, along with the fun battle system in which you can, there are many things you can do with that timing system, like, you can wear an item that like removes the actual markers from that Wheel of Judgment. So if you've memorized when to hit the button, wearing that item will let your attacks be more powerful if you've sort of have the muscle memory for that meter, if that makes any sense. Like, it removes those visual indicators. So if you're good at that, you can have more powerful attacks. But if you're not, then you're going to miss a lot. But it plays with that idea in a lot of fun ways. There are lots of ways to combo your attacks. The characters are really fun. I love the alternate history approach. Which is like, it's so weird that it zeroes in on World War One. It feels like a fairly unpopular war to draw inspiration from, but it's just a fun sort of lighthearted RPG romp that never takes itself too seriously and has just a lot of fun characters and things to do. And I really want to go back to play it, and I wish this was available digitally in some way, because it's a shame that so much of these games are kind of lost unless you have a PS2 or the disc itself.
It's kind of the quintessential PlayStation 2 RPG, right? A period where, like, JRPGs were just taken for granted, right? Nobody was saying, we need to fix the JRPG. The old way is broken.
There's a long history of saying JRPGs are dead, and I think it started around the PS2 era.
But at the same time, within that, like, JRPGs were still very comfortable playing within a particular framework, and Shadow Hearts is no different. But then adding on your own, like, ideas with the battle systems and having your own quirky setting. And in that respect, I think Shadow Hearts like worked pretty well. It wasn't until as you got into the generations after that, you started getting like developers wringing their hands about like trying to shake up the formula, as it were. But Shadow Hearts was, I wouldn't exactly call it the golden era of JRPGs, but it was maybe the silver era.
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting B-tier RPG that I don't think we get anymore. Like, I feel like we either get Square Enix, like, or Dragon Quest stuff in terms of JRPGs and, like, Persona, Or, and then we get like C-list like waifu RPGs for your Vitas and your PS3s, or like even Star Ocean is kind of like that now, where it's like, eh, I'm glad you tried, but it's really not worthwhile. Like, I do miss the weirdo games like Shadow Hearts and Resonance of Fate and things like that, that were not as high budget, but they had ambitions and they were not as pandering or, you know, low effort as a lot of the games I'm seeing now.
I mean, you could argue that the Trails of Cold Steel and those kinds of games are your mid-tier JRPGs.
That's true, yeah. I could be being a little unfair, but I feel like I don't see, they don't have as much of a presence, I think, as they used to.
No, but that's how it is for like all games, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the middle RPG has been cut out. And you still see them, like you could say that Obsidian now makes middle tier RPGs with Pillars of Eternity, and that the Divinity Original Sin series is made by like 100 people in Belgium. But both of those games also go for a very retro kind of look and like a very kind of classical kind of approach. And I would say Shadow Hearts would not say that it's retro. Like Shadow Hearts at the time was a very good looking RPG.
Yeah, it
looked
good.
And like, actually pretty ambitious. Like, it would be the equivalent of a AAA release today.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And it's funny, like, the developer, I believe it was called Sacnoth, I'm pretty sure, Nautilus became Sacnoth, whatever. The developer was actually funded by the composer of Secret of Mana with funding from SNK. They made the Kodelka, I never say that right. They made the RPG Kodelka for the PS1. Shadow Hearts is, like, tangentially related to that, but I found it funny in reading up on this developer. It feels like all B-tier Japanese developers eventually become part of Marvelous, and that's exactly what happened to Sacnoth. Like, Marvelous is just, like, just this conglomeration of every publisher or developer that could not survive alone in Japan. They're just, like, a giant, like, Cronenbergian creature with, like, different parts stitched onto it. And they still make good games, but it's funny, just like, oh, whatever happened to this developer? Oh, they're part of Marvelous now, okay. Well, at least they're doing something.
Now I'm just imagining this Cronenbergian, like, RPG creature.
It has the head of, like, Grasshopper Studios and the the neck of Sacnoth and the tail of Neverland. I don't know. They're just, like, a lot of developers are now just Marvelous, which is good. I mean, I'm glad they're not, like, they can still make games in whatever way they can.
Now I want to go watch Rick and Morty. All right. Yeah, keep sending in your pitches for lesser-known RPGs. I would love to read them on the air. You can send them to either cat.bailey@usgamer.net or PM me over on the US Gamer's actual site, cat.bailey.
I just thought of one thing. Like, it's weird that on the PSN store for the PS4, we get PS2 RPGs, but they're just giving us the bad ones. Like, we'll put Shadow Hearts on there. I mean, like, Dark Cloud, it's okay. Dark Cloud 2 is way, way better.
A lot of people would want to play Dark Cloud 2.
Oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, there's no reason to play Dark Cloud 1 if Dark Cloud 2 exists. But Okage, Shadow King, not good. I mean, I like what it's trying to do, but it's just kind of a bad RPG. Like, I want good RPGs on the store, but I don't know what's stopping them.
Persona 3 Fez made it out, didn't it? And Persona 4?
I'm talking about PS2 classics. I'm not sure.
Both PS2 classics.
Right, but I'm not sure if those versions are on the store.
I think they're on the PS3 is the thing.
Yeah.
You can't get them on the PS4.
It's so stupid in any case.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly plenty of PS2 RPGs that deserve love. And I think the PS4, like the PS2 classics, Shadow Hearts Covenant is the definition of a game that you would want to revisit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I have a copy here. But my PlayStation 2 is put away, and it's going to take me a lot of effort to hook that bad boy up again. And I would honestly like to play through it again. It's a very fun game to play through. It I feel like it's succinct. It's like a 30 to 35 hour RPG, which is like a dream to me now to have an RPG wrap up in 30 hours. And I just had so much fun playing it back in the day, and I really love to have more people be able to play it now.
We can play I Am Setsuna. That's like 20 hours.
That's true, but I'd rather play Shadow Hearts Covenant.
All right, we're out of time, but Axe of the Blood God, you can find us over on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, iHeartRadio, a whole bunch of places.
iHeartRadio.
Yep, I'm trying to get us on Spotify. So do me a favor, go to Stitcher, go to iTunes, leave us a review. We would really appreciate it. positive, negative, whatever. We prefer positive because we love you, so you should love us. You can reach us. You can reach me at @_catbot. You can reach Bob at Bob Servo. Be sure to check out our other podcasts, From Us to You, which is our flagship podcast. And of course, check out Retronauts, which updates every Monday. And Bob, you have a podcast, Talking Simpsons. How's that going?
It's going really well. We're at the end of the very end of the third season. Things are constantly getting better in the show. And doing the show is so great. If you go to Talking Simpsons on the Leisure Time Podcast Network, leisuretimepodcast.com, you can download all the episodes or just look for Talking Simpsons in your podcast device. We've done like 60 of them so far, and we're not going to stop until the show gets extremely bad. So,
third season, I think third season is one of my favorites for sure.
It totally like, rocks.
It's a classic. Yeah. So much good stuff. So anything else to pitch? Oh, yeah, Twitch. Should go check out our Twitch streams. We're streaming pretty much every day right now. Jeremy is doing a countdown of Super Nintendo classics, which is kind of cool. And as the release schedule picks up a lot, we're going to be streaming a lot more. I did 2 days in a row of No Man's Sky, and then we're going to do some Madden, and I may or may not stream some Super Robot Wars OG The Moon Dwellers, which once I get a chance to actually play it, I will be talking about on this podcast. So please look forward to that. And in any case, we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. For Bob and myself, we'll see you again next time. And until then, happy adventuring.